Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding by David Hume, first published in 1748. This reading is based on a text at the website www.earlymoderntexts.com. Reader, Mill Nicholson. Section 11. A Particular Providence and a Future State. I was recently talking with a friend who loves skeptical paradoxes. In this he advanced many principles which, though I can by no means accept them, seem interesting and somewhat related to my chain of reasoning here. So I shall recall them as accurately as I can, in order to submit them to the judgment of the reader. Our conversation began with my admiring the special good fortune of philosophy. It requires entire liberty above all other privileges, and chiefly flourishes from the free opposition of opinions and arguments, and it came into existence in an age and country of freedom and tolerance, and was never cramped, even in its most extravagant principles, by any creeds, confessions, or penal statutes. Apart from the banishment of Protagoras and the death of Socrates, and that came partly from other motives, there are scarcely any instances in ancient history of the kind of bigoted zeal that the present age is so much infested with. Epicurus lived in Athens to an advanced age, in peace and tranquillity. Epicureans were even allowed to be priests, and to officiate at the altar in the most sacred rites of the established religion. And the wisest of all the Roman emperors, Marcus Aurelius, even-handedly gave pensions and salaries to the supporters of every sect of philosophy. To grasp how much philosophy needed this kind of treatment in its youth, reflect that even at present, when it may be supposed to be more hardy and robust, it finds it hard to bear the inclemency of the seasons and the harsh winds of slander and persecution that blow on it. "You admire, as the special good fortune of philosophy," says my friend, "something that seems to result from the natural course of things, and to be unavoidable in every age and nation. This stubborn bigotry that you complain of as so fatal to philosophy is really its offspring, a child who allies himself with superstition, and then separates himself entirely from the interests of his parent, and becomes its most persistent enemy and persecutor. The dogmas of theoretical theology that now cause such furious dispute couldn't possibly have been conceived or accepted in the early ages of the world, when mankind, being wholly illiterate, formed an idea of religion more suitable to their weak understanding, and composed their sacred doctrines not out of learned theories, but mainly out of tales that were the objects of traditional belief more than of argument or disputation. So after the first alarm was over, an alarm arising from the new paradoxes and principles of the philosophers seem throughout the rest of antiquity to have lived in great harmony with the established superstition, and to have made a fair partition of mankind between themselves and the supporters of religion. The former claimed all the learned and wise, the latter possessed all the common and illiterate." "It seems, then," I said, "that you leave politics entirely out of the question, and don't suppose that a wise ruler could ever reasonably oppose certain tenets of philosophy, such as those of Epicurus. They denied the existence of any God, and consequently denied a providence and a future state, and those denials seemed to loosen the ties of morality, and might be supposed for that reason to be pernicious to the peace of civil society." He replied, "I know that in fact these persecutions never ever came from calm reason or from experience of the pernicious consequences of philosophy, but arose entirely from passion and prejudice. But what if I should go further, and assert that if Epicurus had been publicly accused by sycophants or informers, he could easily have defended himself by showing his principles of philosophy to be as salutary as those of his adversaries, who were trying so hard to expose him to public hatred and jealousy?" "I wish," I said, "you would try your eloquence on this extraordinary topic, and make a speech for Epicurus that might satisfy, not the mob of Athens, if you will allow that civilized city to have contained a mob, but the more philosophical listeners who could have understood his arguments. "It will not be hard to do that," he said, "and if you like, I shall suppose myself to be Epicurus for a moment, and make you stand for the Athenian people. And I shall give you a speech that will fill the urn with yes votes, and leave not a single no to gratify the malice of my adversaries." "Very well. Please go ahead." "I come here, Athenians, to justify in your assembly what I maintained in my school, and I find that instead of reasoning with calm and dispassionate inquirers, as I have done in my school, I am impeached by furious antagonists. Your deliberations, which ought to be directed to questions of public good and the interests of the commonwealth, are diverted to the issues of speculative philosophy, and these magnificent, but perhaps fruitless inquiries, have displaced your more ordinary but more useful occupations. I shall do what I can to prevent this abuse. We shall not here discuss philosophical issues about the origin and government of worlds. We shall merely inquire into how far such issues concern the public interest, and if I can persuade you that they have no bearing at all on the peace of society and security of government, I hope you will immediately send us back to our schools, where we can quietly examine the philosophical question that is the most sublime, but also the least relevant to conduct. The religious philosophers, not satisfied with the tradition of your forefathers and the doctrine of your priests, with which I willingly go along, rashly delve into how far they can establish religion on the principles of reason. And in this way they stir up, rather than allay, the doubts that naturally arise from a careful and probing inquiry. They paint in the most magnificent colours the order, beauty, and wise arrangement of the universe, and then ask if such a glorious display of intelligence could come from a random coming together of atoms, or if chance could produce something that the greatest genius can never sufficiently admire. I shan't examine the soundness of this argument. I shall grant that it is as solid as my antagonists and accusers can desire. All I need is to prove from this very reasoning that the question of the existence of a God is entirely theoretical, having no practical import, and that when in my philosophical lectures I deny a providence and a future state, I am not undermining the foundations of society, but rather am advancing solid and satisfactory principles, ones that my accusers and antagonists are themselves committed to by their own lines of thought. You, then, who are my accusers, have acknowledged that the main or sole argument for the existence of a God, which I never questioned, is derived from the order of nature, which bears such marks of intelligence and design, that you think it would be crazy to believe it was caused either by chance or by the blind and unguided force of matter. You agree that this is an argument from effects to causes. From the order of the work, you infer that there must have been planning and forethought in the mind of the workman. You agree that this is how you are arguing, and you don't claim to establish the conclusion in any version that goes beyond what the phenomena of nature will justify. These are your concessions. Now observe their consequences. When we infer any particular cause from an effect, we must proportion the one to the other, and should never ascribe to the cause any qualities beyond what is needed to produce the effect. When a body weighing 10 ounces rises in a scale, this shows that the counterbalancing body weighs more than 10 ounces, but not that it weighs more than 100 ounces. If the cause assigned for any effect isn't sufficient to produce that effect, we must either reject that cause or else add to it such qualities as will make it adequate for the effect. But if we ascribe to it more qualities than are needed for that effect, or affirm it to be capable of producing other effects that we haven't witnessed, that can only be because we are taking the liberty of conjecturing and are arbitrarily supposing the existence of certain qualities and energies without having any reason to do so. The same rule about proportioning the inferred cause to the known effect holds not only when the cause is brute unconscious matter, but also when it is a rational thinking being. If the cause is known only by the effect, we ought never to ascribe to it any qualities beyond what are needed to produce the effect, and no sound rules of reasoning will let us argue back from the cause and infer from it effects other than the ones that led us to it in the first place. The sight of one of Zooks's pictures couldn't tell anyone that he was also a sculptor and an architect, an artist as skilful with stone and marble as with colours. We may safely conclude that the workman has the talents and taste displayed in the particular work we are looking at. The inferred cause must be proportioned to the known effect, and if we exactly and precisely proportion it, we shall never find in it any qualities that tell us anything about other work by this artist, because those would have to be qualities beyond what is merely needed to produce the effect that we are now examining. So if we grant that the gods are the authors of the existence, or the order of the universe, it follows that they have exactly the degree of power, intelligence, and benevolence that appears in their workmanship. But nothing further can ever be proved about them, unless we resort to exaggeration and flattery to make up for the defects of argument and reasoning. We can attribute to the gods any attributes of which we now find traces, but the supposition of further attributes is mere guesswork. Even more of a guess is the supposition that in distant regions of space or periods of time there has been or will be a more magnificent display of these attributes, and a system of administration more suitable to such imaginary virtues as those attributed to the gods. We can never be allowed to rise from the universe, the effect, up to Jupiter, the cause, and then descend again to infer some new effect from that cause, as though we can't do full justice to that deity's glorious attributes if we attribute to him only the effects we already know about. The knowledge of the cause is derived solely from the effect, so they must be exactly adjusted to each other, and one of them can never point to anything further or be the foundation of any new inference and conclusion. You find certain phenomena in nature. You seek a cause or author. You imagine that you have found him. You afterwards become so enamoured of this offspring of your brain that you think he must have produced something greater and more perfect than the world as we see it, so full of badness and disorder. You forget that this superlative intelligence and benevolence are entirely imaginary, or at least without any foundation in reason, and that you have no basis for ascribing to him any qualities except those you see he has actually displayed in his productions. I say to the philosophers, let your gods be suited to the present appearances of nature, and don't alter your account of these appearances so as to make them appropriate to the attributes that you so foolishly ascribe to your deities. When priests and poets, supported by your authority, O Athenians, talk of a gold or silver age that preceded the present state of vice and misery, I hear them with attention and with reverence. But when philosophers, who claim to ignore authority and cultivate reason, say the same things, I admit that I don't give them the same obsequious submission and pious deference that I give to the priests and poets. When they rashly affirm that their gods did or will carry out plans beyond what has actually appeared, I ask, who carried them into the heavenly regions? Who admitted them into the councils of the gods? Who opened to them the book of fate? If they reply that they have climbed the steps or upward ramp of reason, drawing inferences from effects to causes, I still insist that they have aided the ascent of reason by the wings of imagination. Otherwise they couldn't switch and argue downward from causes to effects, presuming that an effect more perfect than the present world would be more suitable to such perfect beings as the gods, and forgetting that what they find in the present world is their sole basis for ascribing to the gods any perfection or any attribute. That is how there comes to be so much fruitless labour to account for things that appear bad in nature, to save the honour of the gods, while we have to admit that the world really does contain much evil and disorder. We are told that what controlled the power and benevolence of Jupiter, and obliged him to make mankind and every sentient creature so imperfect and so unhappy, is the obstinate and intractable nature of matter, or the observance of general laws, or some such reason. His power and benevolence seem to be taken for granted in their most extreme form. And on that supposition, I admit, such conjectures may be accepted as plausible explanations of the bad phenomena. But still I ask, why take these attributes for granted? Why ascribe to the cause any qualities that don't actually appear in the effect? Why torture your brain to justify the course of nature on suppositions which, for all you know to the contrary, may be entirely imaginary, suppositions for which no traces are to be found in the course of nature? The religious hypothesis, therefore, must be considered merely as one way of accounting for the visible phenomena of the universe. But no sound reasoner will ever presume to infer from it any single fact, or to alter or add to the phenomena in any particular case. If you think that the appearances of things prove that they had causes of a certain kind, it's legitimate for you to draw an inference concerning the existence of such causes. In such complicated and high-flown subjects, everyone should be granted the freedom of conjecture and argument. But you ought to stop at that. If you come to argue from your inferred cause that some other fact did or will exist in the course of nature, providing a fuller display of the god's particular attributes, I must tell you severely that you are reasoning wrongly, adding to the attributes of the cause something that goes beyond what appears in the effect. Otherwise, you could never with tolerable sense or propriety add anything to the effect in order to make it more worthy of the cause. Where, then, is the odiousness of the doctrine I teach in my school? What do you find in this whole question that has any bearing on good morals or the peace and order of society? According to you, I deny that there is a providence and a supreme governor of the world who guides the course of events and punishes the vicious with infamy and disappointment, and rewards the virtuous with honour and success. But surely I don't deny the course of events that lies open to everyone's inspection. I agree that in the present order of things, virtue is accompanied by more peace of mind than is vice, and meets with a more favourable reception from the world. I am aware that according to the past experience of mankind, friendship is the chief joy of human life, and moderation is the only source of tranquillity and happiness. Whenever I balance the virtuous course of life against the vicious one, I am aware that to a well-disposed mind every advantage is on the side of the former. And what more can you say, on the basis of all your suppositions and reasonings? You tell me that this arrangement of things, with all the advantages on the side of virtue, is a product of intelligence and design on the part of the gods. But the arrangement itself, on which depends our happiness or misery and consequently our conduct, is still the same, wherever it comes from. It is still open to me to regulate my behaviour by my experience of past events, as you can regulate yours by your experience. You may tell me that if I accept that there is a divine providence and a supreme distributive justice in the universe, I ought to expect more reward of the good and punishment of the bad than appears in the ordinary course of events. If you do, I reply that that's the same fallacy that I tried to expose earlier. You persist in imagining that if we grant the divine existence for which you so earnestly contend, you can safely infer consequences from it, and add something to the experienced order of nature by arguing from the attributes that you ascribe to your gods. You seem to forget that all your reasonings on this subject can only run from effects to causes, and that every argument from causes to effects must of necessity be grossly fallacious, because it's impossible for you to know anything about the cause except what you have previously discovered in the effect and not inferred from it. But what must a philosopher think of those futile reasoners who, instead of regarding the present scene of things as the only object of contemplation, reverse the whole course of nature so drastically as to render this life merely a passage to something further, a porch that leads to a greater and vastly different building, a prologue that serves only to introduce the play and give it more grace and propriety? From where do you think such philosophers can have acquired their idea of the gods? From their own inventive imaginations, surely. For if they derived it from the present phenomena, it would have to be exactly adjusted to them, never pointing to anything beyond them. We can freely allow that the divinity may have attributes that we have never seen exercised, and may be governed by principles of action that we don't see at work. But all this is mere possibility and guesswork. We never can have reason to infer any attributes or motives in the divinity other than those we know to have been exercised and satisfied. Are there any signs of a distributive justice in the world? If you answer yes, I conclude that since justice is here exercised, it is satisfied. If you reply no, I conclude that you then have no reason to ascribe justice, in our sense of it, to the gods. If you take a middle position, and say that the justice of the gods is at present exercised in part, but not in its full extent, I answer that you have no reason to credit it with any extent beyond what you see at present exercised. Thus, O Athenians, my dispute with my antagonists boils down to just this. The course of nature lies open to my view, as well as to theirs. The experienced sequence of events is the great standard by which we all regulate our conduct. Nothing else can be appealed to in battle or in the Senate. Nothing else ought ever to be heard of in the school or in the study. It would be pointless to let our limited intellects break through those boundaries that are too narrow for our foolish imaginations. While we argue from the course of nature, and infer a particular intelligent cause, at first bestowed and still preserves order in the universe, we accept a principle that is both uncertain and useless. It is uncertain because the subject lies entirely beyond the reach of human experience. It is useless because, given that our knowledge of this cause is derived entirely from the course of nature, we can never legitimately return from the cause with any new inference. "I observe," I said, finding that he had finished his speech, "that you are willing to employ the tricks of the demagogues of ancient times. Having chosen me to stand in for the Athenians, you insinuate yourself into my favour by proclaiming principles to which, as you know, I have always expressed a particular attachment. But allowing you to make experience, as indeed I think you ought, the only standard of our judgment about this and all other questions of fact, I am sure that by appealing to the very same experience as you did, I can refute the reasoning that you've put into the mouth of Epicurus. Suppose you saw a half-finished building, surrounded with heaps of brick and stone and mortar, and all the tools of masonry. Couldn't you infer from this effect that it was a work of design and contrivance? And couldn't you argue back down from this inferred cause to infer new additions to the effect, and to conclude that the building would soon be finished, and receive all the further improvements that art could give it? If you saw a human footprint on the seashore, you would conclude that a man had passed that way, and that he had also left the traces of the other foot, though they had been erased by the rolling of the sands or wash of the waves. So why do you refuse to admit the same method of reasoning regarding the order of nature? Consider the world and our present life merely as an imperfect building, from which you can infer a superior intelligence. Then why can't you argue from that superior intelligence, which can leave nothing imperfect, and infer a more finished scheme that will be completed somewhere at some time? Aren't these lines of reasoning exactly similar? How can you justify accepting one and rejecting the other?" He replied, "This difference in my conclusions is justified by the infinite difference of the subjects. In works involving human skill and planning, it's permissible to argue from the effect to the cause, and then to argue back from the cause to new conclusions about the effect, and to look into the alterations that the effect probably has undergone or may undergo in the future. But what is the basis for this method of reasoning? Plainly this: that man is a being whom we know by experience, whose motives and plans we are acquainted with, and whose projects and inclinations are patterned according to the laws that nature has established for the workings of such a creature. So when we find that some work has come from the skill and industry of man, we can draw 100 inferences about what may be expected from him, the basis for these inferences being our knowledge, from experience and observation, of the nature of the human animal. But if we knew man only from the single work or product that we are examining, we couldn't argue in this way, because our knowledge of all the qualities we ascribe to him would in that case be derived from the one product. They couldn't possibly point to anything further, or be the basis for any new inference. A footprint in the sand, when considered alone, can only prove that there was something with that shape by which it was produced. But the human footprint shows also, from our other experience, that there was probably another foot that also left its print, though erased by time or other events. Here we rise from the effect to the cause, and then, descending again from the cause, infer new things about the effect. But this isn't a downward continuation of the same simple chain of reasoning that we used in arguing up to the cause. In this case, we take in 100 other experiences and observations concerning the usual shape and limbs of that species of animal. Without them, this method of argument must be considered fallacious. The case is not the same with our reasonings from the works of nature. God is known to us only by his productions, and is a single being in the universe, not belonging to any species or genus from whose experienced attributes we could, by analogy, infer any attribute in him. As the universe shows wisdom and goodness, we infer wisdom and goodness in him. As it shows a particular degree of these perfections, we infer a particular degree of them in him, exactly proportioned to the effect that we examine. But no rules of sound reasoning will authorize us to infer or suppose any further attributes or further degrees of the same attributes. Now, without some such license to suppose, we can't argue from the cause or infer anything in the effect beyond what we have immediately observed. Greater good produced by this being must come from a greater degree of goodness. A more impartial distribution of rewards and punishments must come from a greater regard for justice and equity. Everything we suppose in addition to the works of nature requires an addition to the attributes of the author of nature, and consequently, having no support from any reason or argument, has to be regarded as mere conjecture and guesswork. The great source of our mistake in this subject, and of the unbounded license to suppose that we allow ourselves, is that we think of ourselves as in the Supreme Being's place, and conclude that he will always behave in the way we would find reasonable and acceptable if we were in his situation. But the ordinary course of nature should convince us that almost everything in it is regulated by principles and maxims very different from ours. And anyway, it is obviously contrary to all rules of analogy to reason from the intentions and projects of men to those of a being who is so different from them and so much superior. In human nature, there is a certain experienced coherence of designs and inclinations, so that when, from some fact, we discover one intention of a man, it may often be reasonable in the light of experience to infer another, and draw a long chain of conclusions about his past or future conduct. But it can never be right to reason in this way regarding a being who is so remote and incomprehensible, who is less like any other being in the universe than the sun is like a wax candle, and who reveals himself only by some faint traces or outlines, beyond which we have no basis for ascribing to him any attribute or perfection. What we imagine to be a superior perfection may really be a defect. And even if it is utterly a perfection, to credit the Supreme Being with having it, when it doesn't seem to have been exercised to the full in his works, smacks more of flattery and praise-singing than of valid reasoning and sound philosophy. Thus all the philosophy in the world and all the religion, which is simply one kind of philosophy, will never be able to carry us beyond the usual course of experience, or give us standards of conduct and behaviour different from those that are provided by reflections on common life. No new fact can ever be inferred from the religious hypothesis, no event foreseen or foretold, no reward or punishment expected or dreaded, beyond what is already known by practice and observation. So my speech on behalf of Epicurus will still appear solid and satisfactory. The political interests of society have no connection with the philosophical disputes about metaphysics and religion. "There is still one point," I replied, "that you seem to have overlooked. Even if I allow your premises, I must deny your conclusion. You conclude that religious doctrines and reasonings can have no influence on life because they ought to have no influence. This ignores the fact that men don't reason in the same manner as you do, but draw many consequences from the belief in a divine being, and suppose that God will inflict punishments on vice and bestow rewards on virtue, beyond what appear in the ordinary course of nature. It makes no difference whether this reasoning of theirs is sound. Its influence on their life and conduct will be the same either way. And those who try to cure them of such prejudices may, for all I know, be good reasoners, but I can't judge them to be good citizens and participants in politics, because by freeing men from one restraint on their passions, they make it in one way easier and safer for them to infringe the laws of society. After all, I may agree to your general conclusion in favour of liberty, though I would argue from different premises from yours, and I think that the state ought to tolerate every principle of philosophy, and no government has ever suffered in its political interests through such indulgence. There is no fanaticism among philosophers. Their doctrines aren't very attractive to the people, and their reasonings can't be restrained, except by means that must endanger the sciences and even the state, by paving the way for persecution and oppression on other matters, ones where the people are more deeply involved and concerned. But your main line of thought, I continued, involves a difficulty that I shall just mention without insisting on it, lest it lead into reasonings of too subtle and delicate a nature. Briefly, then, I very much doubt that it's possible for a cause to be known only by its effect, as you have supposed all through, or to be so singular and particular that it has no parallel or similarity with any other cause or object we have ever observed. It is only when two kinds of objects are found to be constantly conjoined that we can infer one from the other, and if we encountered an effect that was entirely singular, and couldn't be placed in any known kind, I don't see that we could conjecture or infer anything at all concerning its cause. If experience and observation and analogy really are the only guides we can reasonably follow in inferences of this sort, both the effect and the cause must have some similarity to other effects and causes that we already know, and have found often to be conjoined with each other. So the antagonists of Epicurus were wrong to suppose that the universe, an effect that is quite singular and unparalleled, is proof of a God, a cause no less singular and unparalleled. But since they did think this, it is worthwhile for you to point out that they went wrong again at the next step, claiming to return from the cause to the effect, and by reasoning from their ideas of the cause, infer anything new about the effect. End of section 11.